This episode is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 63 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Definitely worth checking out if you're taking the exam.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's get into it. Welcome to our deep dive into the wildly specific, sometimes totally baffling world of investment advisor regulation.
Baffling is definitely the right word for it. It's a corner of the financial universe that honestly catches a lot of really smart people completely off guard.
Oh, I believe it. And I want to frame this for you, the listener, right out of the gate. If you are prepping for the Series 63, today's deep dive represents about 5% of your exam.
Right, which translates to roughly 3 questions.
Exactly, 3 questions. Now, you might hear that and think, 3 questions? Why are we dedicating an entire deep dive to this?
It's a fair question.
I'll tell you why. It's because this is the foundational bedrock of the entire Uniform Securities Act. I mean, if you don't know who is and who isn't an investment advisor, literally none of the other rules make any sense.
Yeah, it's like trying to play chess without knowing how the knight moves. Yeah. You're just going to be guessing the whole time.
That is exactly it. You'll just be guessing. So our mission today is to reverse engineer the minds of the state regulators, the administrators.
Because if we can understand their regulatory intent, if we can see the world the way they see it, you'll be able to anticipate the exam's trick questions before you even finish reading the prompt.
Right. And for those of us with ADHD who zone out during dry lectures, we are not just going to read statutory definitions. That is a cure for insomnia.
Oh, absolutely. Memorizing vocabulary lists will fail you on test day anyway.
So to make this stick, we are going to follow the chaotic careers of 3 fictional friends. Think of them as our crash test dummies for state securities law.
I love this approach. Putting a human face on these abstract rules really helps anchor the concepts.
Yeah. So let's introduce the cast of characters. First up, we have Paula the Planner.
Paula the Planner.
Okay. Paula is sharp, she's ambitious, and she is always looking for a loophole. Like, if there is a regulatory gray area, Paula has pitched a tent and is currently camping in it.
We all know a Paula.
We really do. Next, we have Bob the Broker. Bob is this well-meaning but perpetually confused broker-dealer agent. He genuinely wants to help his clients, but he just keeps, stumbling blindly over regulatory tripwires.
Poor Bob. He's trying his best.
He is. And finally, we have Fiona the Federal Advisor. Fiona is a high-rolling Wall Street powerhouse handling hundreds of millions of dollars. She operates on a totally different level.
But as we'll see, even Fiona can't entirely escape the long arm of the state administrator.
Right. So Paula, Bob, and Fiona, we are going to put them through the ringer today.
Let's do it. Where do we start?
Well, before a state regulator can enforce rules on an investment advisor, they have to actually catch one, right? Like, how does the state even define an investment advisor in the first place?
Yeah, so if you look at the Uniform Securities Act, the USA, it lays out a very specific multi-pronged definition.
And it is a massive run-on sentence. I read it and my eyes glazed over.
It's terrible. It basically states that an investment advisor is any person who, for compensation, engages in the business of advising others, either directly or through publications, as to the value of securities.
I'm already asleep. We need to break that down. Like, give me a mechanism I can actually hold on to.
Okay, the legal industry uses a shorthand for this called the ABC test.
ABC test.
Advice, business, compensation. Those are the 3 core elements. And here's the kicker. All 3 of those elements must be present simultaneously.
ABC. Advice, business, compensation. Okay, people always call this a 3-legged stool, but I think that's kind of passive. I prefer to think of this as a 3-digit combination lock on a bank vault.
Oh, I like that, a combination lock.
Right, because if you dial in advice, that's the first number, click. If you dial in business, that's the second number, click. But unless you also dial in compensation, that vault door does not open.
Exactly. The state does not get to regulate you as an IA. The lock stays shut.
You have to hit all 3. So let's test that combination lock with Paula the Planner.
Okay, let's see what Paula is up to.
Let's say Paula has a brilliant mind for the markets. She spends her weekends doing deep fundamental analysis on biotech companies, and she gives incredible stock advice to her friends.
So that's the advice digit entered.
Yep. Let's even say she does it so regularly and systematically that it clearly meets the definition of a business. She's got spreadsheets. She sends out a weekly email blast to 100 people.
Okay, so we have A and B dialed in, the first 2 digits.
But Paula happens to be independently wealthy and does all of this purely out of the goodness of her heart. 0 compensation. Does the vault open? Listener, I want you to think about it for a second.
Yeah, run the algorithm in your head.
The lock stays shut. She is completely outside the definition.
She is. Because the compensation digit was never entered, she does not meet the legal threshold.
So she's not an IA.
Missing one single element means she's not an investment advisor under the USA.
Yeah.
She's just a very generous, financially literate citizen. The state administrator has no jurisdiction over her weekly email blasts.
That makes total sense. Let's try changing the combination. What if Bob the broker gives paid advice?
Okay, so we have compensation and advice dialed in.
Right, but he only did it one single time as a favor for his cousin's neighbor. He doesn't advertise. He doesn't do this regularly. Like, he is not in the business of giving advice.
Again, the vault stays locked. Not an IA.
Wait, really? Even though he got paid?
Yeah, because the business element of the ABC test requires a degree of regularity. It doesn't have to be your only business or even your primary business, but it cannot be a rare, isolated, one-off situation.
Okay, so you have to hold yourself out or engage in it with enough frequency that it actually constitutes a business activity.
Exactly. The state isn't trying to regulate a guy who gave one good tip for $50 once in his life.
Fair enough. Let's play with the first digit, the advice piece. What if Paula is running a highly lucrative business, charging thousands of dollars in fees, but she only advises clients on the best neighborhoods to buy commercial real estate?
Or, like, which vintage sports cars are going up in value?
Yeah, exactly. Cars, real estate, art.
The lock still doesn't open. The advice must specifically be about securities.
Okay, listener, this is huge.
It is. Real estate, rare coins, fine art, stamps, vintage cars, none of that triggers the investment advisor definition because none of those things are securities under the USA.
Got it. Now, I want to drill down into the compensation digit because from my reading of the source material, this is exam gotcha number one.
Oh, yeah. The test writers love to lay traps here.
Right, because when a normal person hears the word compensation, their mind goes straight to an hourly rate or a fixed asset under management fee.
An invoice, basically.
Exactly. But the regulators view this entirely differently, don't they?
They view it through an incredibly wide lens. The regulators know that financial professionals are clever.
Right. Oh, they definitely are.
And if compensation was strictly defined as a direct hourly fee, everyone would just relabel their fees to avoid registration. So the interpretation of compensation is explicitly defined as any economic benefit.
Any economic benefit. That phrase is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
A ton of heavy lifting.
Let's bring Bob the broker back in. Bob sits down with a prospective client and says, look, I'm a fiduciary kind of guy, even though I'm just a broker. I give totally free investment advice.
They missed last words.
Right. He says, my advice is free. Now, if you happen to buy the mutual fund I just suggested, I'll earn a standard sales commission on the execution of the trade. But the portfolio analysis, that was on the house. Is Bob safe?
Not even slightly. Bob is receiving an economic benefit in connection with the advisory services.
But he didn't charge for the advice.
It doesn't matter. That commission is indirect compensation. He is getting paid for the advice through the mechanism of the product sale.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the compensation element is absolutely satisfied.
Okay, what if we get totally absurd with it just to find the absolute limit of the law?
I love absurd. Let's do it.
Let's say Bob gives weekly portfolio advice to the owner of his local deli. And in exchange, Bob doesn't take a dime, but the deli owner gives Bob a massive, expensive pastrami sandwich every Tuesday. Is a sandwich compensation?
Okay, if the sandwich is provided as a quid pro quo for the securities advice, yes, it's an economic benefit.
You're kidding. A pastrami sandwich makes you an IA.
Strictly legally speaking, yes. The state regulators are not easily fooled by bartering. If you are getting something of measurable value in return for telling people what to buy or sell, you are being compensated.
That is wild.
Now, is an administrator going to launch a full-scale federal investigation over a pastrami sandwich? Probably not. But for the purposes of the exam, any economic benefit satisfies the C in the ABC test.
Listener, remember the pastrami sandwich, any economic benefit. Okay, let's look at a much more common real-world trap.
The bundled fee trick.
Yes. Paula the planner markets herself as a holistic financial planner. She charges a flat fee of, let's say, $3,000 for a comprehensive financial lifestyle plan.
Okay, I can see where this is going.
She hands the client a massive binder, and she tells them, listen, the $3,000 is purely for the budgeting software, the tax mitigation strategies, and the estate planning overview. The specific investment recommendations in Chapter 4 of the binder, I throw that in as a complimentary bonus.
Yeah, no. The regulators have seen this exact trick a million times, particularly since the 1980s.
So she's caught.
Completely caught.
Yeah.
If a financial planner charges a single bundled fee for a comprehensive package that includes investment recommendations, they're receiving compensation for investment advice.
You can't just unbundle it in your verbal marketing to escape the definition.
Exactly. The fee covers the whole binder, and the binder contains securities advice. Boom. Compensation.
That actually brings us perfectly to the historical context I want to dig into. The 1986 NASA amendment.
Ah, yes. NASA, the North American Securities Administrators Association.
Why did they feel the need to amend the rules specifically regarding financial planners back then?
Well, you have to look at what was happening in the 1980s. The financial planning industry was exploding. You had a massive influx of professionals calling themselves financial planners, wealth consultants, or financial engineers.
Right, everyone wanted a fancy title.
And a huge percentage of them were playing the exact game Paula just played. They were claiming they were primarily doing budgeting or insurance, and the investment advice was just an incidental freebie, so they weren't in the business of advising.
So NASA stepped in.
They had to. To close this gaping loophole, NASA explicitly brought financial planners into the regulatory fold through what we call the holding out rule.
The holding out rule. This is fascinating. So if Paula puts an ad on Facebook that says, Paula's total financial planning and investment consulting, she's holding herself out to the public as an advisor.
Right. And the regulatory logic is beautiful in its simplicity. If you market yourself to the public as someone who provides investment advisory services for compensation, you cannot later turn around to the regulator and claim, "Oh, I'm not actually in the business of doing that."
Your own marketing material seals the deal.
Exactly.
Okay, listener, it'll be a pattern interrupt. Think fast. I want you to run this scenario through your head.
Pay attention. This is a tricky one.
If Paula puts up a billboard on the highway saying, Paula's investment planning, does the state administrator still need to subpoena her client records to prove she is actually in the business of advising with sufficient regularity?
Take a beat to think about how the lock mechanism works here.
The answer is no. Holding yourself out automatically satisfies the business digit of the ABC combination lock.
Yep. You put up the billboard, you just handed the regulator that requirement wrapped in a bell.
You don't even have to actually have any clients yet. The act of holding yourself out is being in the business.
I do want to clarify one nuance there, though.
Sir, what's that?
If a financial planner holds themselves out, but they strictly and exclusively give advice on non-securities, let's say they only do debt management or they only analyze life insurance policies, they aren't caught by the IA definition.
Because life insurance isn't a security.
Right. But the moment securities advice enters the chat and they are holding themselves out as a planner, they are an IA.
Okay, so when our listener is sitting in the exam room taking the Series 63 and they see a question asking if someone meets the definition of an investment advisor, what is the immediate mental checklist? Like, how do they avoid the traps?
You systematically run the fact pattern through the ABC test. Advice, business, compensation. Look for the missing piece.
Did the prompt explicitly state the advice was free and a one-time favor for a friend?
Not an IA.
Are they giving brilliant paid advice on buying physical gold bars?
Not an IA. Gold isn't a security.
But if the prompt mentions a financial planner charging a comprehensive fee or a broker claiming their advice is free but earning indirect commissions on the back end?
The compensation trap has been sprung. They are an IA.
Okay, so we've established how the state casts its net to catch investment advisors. A, B, C. It is a very wide net.
Very wide.
But what happens when the net pulls in someone who the law has decided shouldn't be regulated by this specific statute? Let's talk about the VIPs who get to skip the velvet rope at the regulatory nightclub.
This is a grand delineation in securities law, and it is a massive area for exam questions.
Because it relies on two words that sound identical in plain English, right?
Exactly, but they have entirely different legal meanings. Exclusion versus exemption. Understanding the difference between being excluded and being exempt is arguably the most critical conceptual hurdle of the exam.
Let's lay them out side by side. If I'm standing outside the hottest club in town, we'll call it club regulation. What does it mean if the bouncer tells me I am excluded versus if he tells me I am exempt? Like, how does the mechanism actually work?
Okay, let's start with exclusion. If you are excluded, the bouncer looks at his master list, looks at you, and says, "You don't even belong at this club. This club is for investment advisors. According to my list, you are definitionally not an investment advisor. Go home."
So the definition entirely ignores me.
Yes, because you are legally not an IA, you owe no registration, and you have absolutely no IA-specific duties. You don't file a form ADV, you don't have to deliver brochures to your clients, you don't have to maintain minimum net worth requirements.
Wow. So the IA rules simply do not exist for me.
They do not exist for you.
Okay, so exclusion means I am completely outside the blast radius of the definition. I'm not an IA. What if I walk up to the bouncer and he says I am exempt?
If you are exempt, the bouncer says, okay, I see you are an investment advisor. You meet the ABC test. You belong in the club. But you were on the VIP list tonight, so you don't have to wait in the registration line or pay the cover charge.
Oh, I like the sound of that.
Right. An exempt person, I as an investment advisor, but they are excused from the specific administrative act of registering with the state.
I want to make sure I understand the gravity of that. If I am exempt, I skip the paperwork, but do I still have to act like an IA?
Yes. And that is the crucial difference. An exempt advisor still has to follow the behavioral and operational rules of being an IA. They just don't have to formally register. An excluded person isn't an IA at all.
That distinction is fantastic. Listener, write this down. Exclusion means not an IA. Exemption means is an IA, but skips the registration line.
Perfectly said.
B-U-A-T. And this is the ultimate rule, the one we need to hammer into the foundation right now before we go any further. I'm going to set this up, and I want you to knock it down.
I know exactly where you're going. Lay it on me.
Nobody escapes Section 102 anti-fraud rules.
Nobody.
If you get paid to give advice about securities, you cannot commit fraud, period. It does not matter if you are excluded. It does not matter if you are exempt. It does not matter if you are managing $1 trillion or $100.
Nope. Doesn't matter.
If you give paid advice about securities and you lie, cheat, or steal, the state administrator will come for you with the full force of the law.
I couldn't have said it better. There is absolutely no exemption from fraud. Section 102 of the Uniform Securities Act reaches anyone who receives consideration for advising others about securities.
So even if you fit neatly into an exclusion, even if the definition of an IA doesn't apply to you, you are still legally bound by the anti-fraud provisions.
Right. You can't defraud people and then hide behind an exclusion claiming, well, technically I'm not an investment advisor. The state does not care. Fraud is fraud.
Okay, so with the anti-fraud blanket covering everyone, who are these lucky people who get excluded from the definition entirely? Who gets told by the bouncer that they aren't even IAs?
The USA carves out 7 specific categories of exclusions.
7 categories. Why did the writers of the law carve these specific people out?
The logic behind most of them is that these entities are already heavily regulated by some other body, or their advice is so minimal it doesn't warrant a separate layer of state bureaucracy.
Give me the list.
Okay, I'll list them out. 1, investment advisor representatives, or IIRs.
The human employees, not the firm itself.
Exactly. 2, banks, savings institutions, and trust companies. 3, a group of specific professionals we'll detail in a moment. 4, broker-dealers and their agents.
Bob the broker's crew.
Yep. 5, publishers of bona fide publications. 6, federal covered advisors.
Fiona's crowd.
And 7, anyone else the administrator decides to designate by rule or order.
I want to zoom in on category number 2 for a second. Banks and trust companies. The exam loves to test the boundaries of this.
It's a classic trap.
Right, because a local credit union or a state chartered bank is excluded. They can give investment advice, and they are not IAs. But what about a bank holding company?
Yeah, that is exam gotcha territory. A bank holding company is a corporation that owns one or more banks, but it is not a bank itself.
Oh, so it's a separate corporate entity.
Exactly. Therefore, a bank holding company is not excluded from the definition of an investment advisor. Only the actual bank or trust company gets the exclusion.
Good to know. Now let's tackle the third group, the professionals. This is a heavy hitter on the exam.
Very heavy.
Thankfully, there is a universal mnemonic for this. L-A-T-E, late.
L-A-T-E.
Yes. Lawyers, accountants, teachers, and engineers. L-A-T-E.
So if I am an engineer, I can just open up shop, give out investment advice all day long, charge people for it, and not be regulated as an IA. Why would the law allow that?
They absolutely do not allow that. There is a massive flashing neon condition attached to the LATE exclusion.
Okay, what is the condition?
To understand why, you have to look back at the 1940s when these regulatory concepts were first being drafted. Lawyers, accountants, teachers, and engineers were viewed as the trusted professionals of a community.
Like the pillars of town society.
Right. The lawmakers knew that people naturally asked these professionals for advice, including financial advice. So they created an exclusion, but with a strict limitation. The advice must be solely incidental to the practice of their primary profession. Solely incidental. Let's unpack the mechanics of that phrase with an absurd scenario. Let's introduce Tommy, the teacher.
Let's see what Tommy is doing.
Tommy teaches 10th grade high school economics. During his class, he does a whole unit on how the stock market works, the difference between equities and fixed income, and he mentions a few specific blue chip companies as examples of good dividend payers.
Okay, that sounds like a great teacher.
He is literally giving advice about the value of securities. Is Tommy excluded?
Yes, Tommy is safely excluded. That advice, or education, is solely incidental to his primary profession of being a teacher. He's teaching an economics class. Discussing securities is a natural, expected, and incidental part of doing his job.
He isn't acting as an investment advisor, he's acting as a teacher.
Precisely.
Okay, but what if Tommy the teacher decides he wants a side hustle to supplement his teacher's salary?
Oh, cool.
He starts an after-school group called the Alpha Generators Crypto and Stock Picking Club.
Oh, Tom.
He tells the students, hey, if you pay me $50 a semester, I will give you my specific buy and sell recommendations every Thursday afternoon.
The exclusion evaporates instantly. The moment he charges a separate fee for the advice, or the moment he holds himself out as providing dedicated investment advice outside the scope of his normal curriculum, it is no longer incidental to teaching high school economics.
It is a separate, distinct advisory business.
Tommy just became an investment advisor, and he better get registered before the administrator finds out.
What about a lawyer? Paula the planner has a sister, Laura the lawyer.
Keeping it in the family.
Laura drafts a complex estate plan and a will for a wealthy client. During the meeting, Laura suggests that, given the client's age, the inheritance funds currently sitting in high-risk tech stocks should probably be reallocated into conservative municipal bonds to preserve capital. Is Laura excluded?
Yes. That advice is solely incidental to the legal practice of estate planning. You can't effectively draft an estate plan without discussing the nature of the assets.
What if Laura, the lawyer, realizes she's really good at the investment part, so she puts an ad in the local paper that says, Laura's Law Firm. Estate law and expert portfolio management.
Exclusion lost. By holding herself out as an expert portfolio manager, the advice is no longer incidental. It is a primary service she is marketing. She has crossed the line from excluded professional to regulated investment advisor.
Let's bring Bob the broker back into the mix. Broker dealers are on the exclusion list in category 4.
Yes, they are.
But Bob actually has a tougher time staying excluded than the LATE professionals do, doesn't he? He has a double hurdle to jump.
He does, and the historical reason for this is that the line between selling a security and advising on a security is incredibly thin.
I mean, they kind of look like the same thing to a retail client.
Exactly. So for Bob the broker to maintain his exclusion from the IA definition, he has to satisfy two distinct tests simultaneously. First, just like the LAT folks, the advisory services must be solely incidental to his broker-dealer business.
Which makes sense mechanically. A broker's primary job is executing trades. Giving a little advice on what to trade, hey, I think this stock is a good buy, is incidental to the act of executing the purchase.
Exactly. But here's the second hurdle, and it's the one that trips up brokers all the time. Bob must receive NO, special compensation, for that advice.
No special compensation. What does that mean in Bob's world? Because Bob doesn't work for free.
It means Bob can earn his normal, traditional commissions or markups on the trades he executes. If Bob says, I think you should buy 100 shares of Tech Corp, and the client says, do it, and Bob earns a $50 commission on the trade, he's fine.
The advice was incidental, and the compensation was a standard commission.
He remains excluded.
But what if Bob decides to modernize his business? What if he tells his client, I will analyze your entire portfolio, run a Monte Carlo simulation, and tell you exactly what to buy and sell, but I'm going to charge you a flat fee of $500 for the analysis, PLUSS. I'll still charge you my normal commissions on the trades.
That $500 flat fee is special compensation. It is clearly distinguishable from a trade execution commission. The moment he charges that fee, the exclusion vanishes, and Bob transforms into an investment advisor.
So the flat fee is the trigger.
Yeah, this is why the rise of wrap fee programs in the 1990s completely changed the industry. A wrap fee is a single fee that covers both advice and execution. Any broker-dealer offering a wrap fee program automatically loses the exclusion and must register as an investment advisor because the wrap fee constitutes special compensation.
So Bob charges a flat fee or a wrap fee, and poof, he's an IA. That is a massive operational shift for a broker.
It really is.
Now, I want to move to the publisher exclusion, because this is exam gotcha number two.
This is a big one.
This is where the test writers actively try to play psychological tricks on the test taker. They are going to throw a scenario at you and try to distract you with massive numbers and the size of the publication.
It's a classic misdirection play. The publisher exclusion applies to publishers of bona fide newspapers, news magazines, or financial publications of general and regular circulation.
But here is the trick, listener. Under state law, there is absolutely no circulation or subscriber test.
None. Zero.
Meaning the state administrator does not care if you have 3 million subscribers or 3 subscribers. A tiny self-published newsletter run out of a guy's basement qualifies for the exclusion just as much as the Wall Street Journal, provided it meets one specific mechanical test.
Right.
What is that test? Where did it come from?
The legal foundation for this actually traces back to a 1985 Supreme Court case, Lowe v. SEC.
Lowe v. SEC. What happened there?
Well, a man named Christopher Lowe had his investment advisor registration revoked because of criminal convictions. So he just started publishing an investment newsletter instead.
Ah, a little loophole.
The SEC tried to shut him down, but the Supreme Court ruled that he was acting as a bona fide publisher, and shutting him down would violate his First Amendment rights to free speech.
Wow, so it became a constitutional issue.
Exactly. The state laws mirror this logic. The only test that matters is this. Is the advice impersonal and general? Or is it tailored to the specific investment situation of the individual?
It's a test of one size fits all versus customized advice.
That's exactly it.
Okay, listener, direct question for you. Let's see if you can spot the trap. Paula the planner decides to pivot. She drops her financial planning business and starts a daily stock tip newsletter.
Okay, in newsletter.
She only sends this newsletter to her 10 wealthiest clients, and she explicitly picks the stocks in the newsletter based on those 10 clients' specific tax brackets, their age, and their risk tolerances. They pay a hefty subscription fee. Is Paula excluded as a publisher?
Think about the mechanism here. Impersonal versus tailored. Does she get the exclusion?
The answer is no.
Right. And it has nothing to do with the fact that it's called a newsletter.
Why does she fail?
Because the advice is tailored to the specific tax brackets and risk tolerances of those 10 people. The advice is highly personalized. The publisher exclusion is instantly lost if the content responds to the specific investment needs of the subscriber.
What if Paula goes the other route? She starts a Substack, she charges $20 a month, she gets 5,000 subscribers, and she just posts her general thoughts on the macro economy and the tech sector and says, I think everyone should be buying CloudCorp right now.
She is completely excluded. Yes, it's paid. Yes, she's giving advice about securities, but the advice is general and impersonal. It goes out to all 5,000 subscribers equally, regardless of their personal financial situation.
So she is acting as a publisher, exercising free speech, not acting as an investment advisor.
Precisely.
It's brilliant how specific these dividing lines are. So let's assume you've run the gauntlet, you meet the ABC test, and you don't qualify for any of the exclusions we just discussed.
Right. You aren't LATE, you aren't a broker, you aren't a publisher.
Congratulations, you are officially an investment advisor.
Yay. Now the real fun begins.
Right. Now what? The state doesn't just send you a badge in the mail. You have to deal with the paperwork. Where and how do you get registered? Let's dive into the mechanics of state registration.
The central beating heart of the registration process is Form ADV.
Form ADV.
This is the uniform application used for IA registration across the board, whether you are going state or federal. It's a massive document, but you need to understand how it's structured because the exam will test you on who gets which part.
Let's break down Form ADV. It has several distinct parts, Part 1, Part 2A, Part 2B, and Part 3. Why is it chopped up like this?
It's chopped up because different audiences need different information. Part 1 is primarily written for the regulator.
Okay, so it's the boring stuff.
Very boring. It's a check-the-box, fill-in-the-blank format that contains all the firm's vital statistics, who owns the firm, where are the bank accounts, what is the business model, and crucially, the disciplinary history of the firm and its officers.
So the administrator reads Part 1 to decide if they should let you operate.
Exactly. A client would find it incredibly boring and hard to read.
Okay, so Part 1 goes to the state. What about Part 2A?
Part 2A is the firm brochure. The philosophy here is that disclosure is the best disinfectant. This part must be written in plain English narrative form.
Ah, plain English. So no legalese.
Right. It describes the firm's services, the fee schedule, the types of clients they take, and any conflicts of interest. This is the document that must be delivered to the client before or at the time of entering into an advisory contract.
So Part 2A is the firm brochure. What about Part 2B?
Part 2B is the brochure supplement. If Part 2A is about the firm, Part 2B is about the specific human beings who will actually be giving advice to the client.
Oh, like a resume.
Exactly like a resume. It details the qualifications, educational background, and disciplinary history of the specific investment advisor representatives managing that client's account.
And finally, Part 3.
Part 3 is Form CRS, the Client Relationship Summary. It's a relatively new addition, heavily used by dual registrants people who are both broker-dealers and IAs and SEC-registered advisors.
What's in it?
It's a short, 2-to-4-page summary of fees, conflicts, and standard of conduct, designed to be easily digestible for retail investors.
Okay, the exam loves to test the delivery rules. Listener, if a question asks what document a client must receive before signing a contract, the answer is the brochure Part 2A and the supplement Part 2B.
The client does not get Part 1.
Right. Now, along with Form ADV, an applicant must file something called a consent to service of process.
Yes. The consent to service.
I've always thought the standard metaphors for this are weak. Let's explain what this actually does mechanically.
Mechanically, the consent to service of process is an irrevocable legal forwarding address. You are legally appointing the state administrator as your agent to receive civil legal documents, like subpoenas or lawsuits, on your behalf.
So if a client wants to sue Paula for terrible advice, they don't have to hire a private investigator to hunt Paula down at her house or stake out her office to physically hand her the lawsuit?
No, that would be a nightmare.
They just serve the papers to the state administrator, and the administrator says, consider Paula served. And from that moment, the legal clock starts ticking for Paula, whether she knows about it yet or not.
Exactly. And it is entirely irrevocable. You file it one CE during your initial registration. It never requires annual renewal.
And here is the kicker the exam loves to test. It remains effective even if Paula closes her business.
This is a huge point.
If Paula retires, terminates her registration, and moves to a cabin in the woods, and 3 years later a former client sues her for something she did while she was registered, the administrator can still accept service on her behalf. She cannot escape her past liabilities by deregistering.
It is basically a permanent tattoo.
Irrevocable legal forwarding address. Filed once, outlives the business. Okay, so Paula files her ADV, files her consent, and pays her filing fee. When can she actually start charging clients? Does it happen instantly when she hits submit?
No. There is a mandatory effectiveness clock. Registration becomes effective at noon on the 30th day after a complete application is filed.
Why noon? Why not midnight?
It's about administrative clarity. Midnight creates ambiguity. Is it the end of the 29th day or the beginning of the 30th?
Mm.
Noon is undeniable. The regulator is in the office. The business day is active.
Provided, of course, that the administrator hasn't issued a denial order or initiated a proceeding to look closer at the application.
Right. The administrator has the power to speed it up. They can grant effectiveness in 10 days if they want.
Right.
But noon on the 30th day is the automatic statutory clock.
Okay, so noon on the 30th day. And once she's registered, how long does that registration last? I'm going to use some aggressive repetition here because this is a core mechanical fact of state law. Listener, when do registrations expire?
December 31st.
Every year?
Every single year. Universally.
What if Paula registers on November 15th? Does she get a full year until the next November?
No. Her registration expires 6 weeks later on December 31st of that same year. She will have to pay the renewal fee almost immediately.
For broker-dealers.
December 31st.
For agents.
December 31st.
For investment advisors and their human reps.
December 31st. Everyone renews at the end of the calendar year.
Why do they do it like that? It seems unfair to the November folks.
The states do this for pure administrative efficiency. They don't want to track thousands of different rolling expiration dates. They sweep everyone into one massive renewal period in December.
Drive that home, listener. December 31st, universal expiration date. Okay, let's talk about geography and cross-border business. Let's say Paul the Planner is officially state registered in Texas. That's her home base, her principal office.
Okay.
But her YouTube channel is taking off, and she wants to start taking on clients across the border in Oklahoma. Does she have to register in Oklahoma too?
That depends entirely on whether she meets one of the two out-of-state exemptions. But before we even look at the exemptions, there's an absolute non-negotiable prerequisite.
What is it?
To claim an exemption in Oklahoma, she must have no place of business in Oklahoma.
None. Zero. What constitutes a place of business?
Well, if Paula has a tiny, unstaffed broom closet office in Tulsa, where she meets a client once a year, that's a place of business.
Okay. What if it's not a real office?
If she advertises a P.O. box, or a hotel conference room in Oklahoma as a place where clients can meet her, that's a place of business. If she has any physical location held out to the public in that state, she must register there. The exemptions are instantly off the table.
Okay, so Paula is careful. She has absolutely no office, no P.O. box, nothing physical in Oklahoma. She operates purely out of Texas over Zoom and email. What are her two paths to avoid registering in Oklahoma while taking on clients there?
Path one is the institutional client exemption.
Institutional.
The philosophy here is that highly sophisticated entities do not need the state administrator to hold their hand. If she has no place of business in the state, she could have an unlimited number of institutional clients there.
Who counts as institutional?
This includes banks, trust companies, other investment advisors, insurance companies, or employee benefit plans with over $1 million in assets. She could have 5,000 institutional clients in Oklahoma, and as long as she has no office there, she does not register.
Wow, okay. Institutional clients are unlimited. What is path two?
Path two is a de minimis exemption, again, requiring no place of business in the state. Under this rule, she is allowed to have a very small footprint of regular retail clients before the state demands she register.
What's the limit?
The limit is 5 or fewer non-institutional clients in the state during the preceding 12 months.
5 or fewer retail clients in a rolling 12-month period. Why 5?
It's a compromise. The state wants to allow for casual cross-border commerce. Maybe a Texas client retires and moves to Oklahoma. Paula shouldn't have to register in a new state just to keep her one long-time client.
Makes sense.
But the state also wants to protect its citizens. They decided that 6 retail clients is the threshold where you are actively exploiting the local market and you need to be regulated locally.
Okay, listener, direct question time again. Let's put this logic puzzle together. Paula the planner has no office in Oklahoma. Over the last 12 months, she has acquired 35 institutional clients in Oklahoma and 4 retail non-institutional clients in Oklahoma. Does she need to register there?
Take a beat. Run the algorithm in your head. Office, institutions, retail.
The answer is NO. She does not register.
That's right. Let's break down the mechanics. Step one, does she have an office?
Yeah.
So she is eligible for the exemptions. Step two, look at the client types. Institutional clients are unlimited, so the 35 banks and trust companies don't trigger registration. They are essentially invisible to the count.
Invisible. Love that.
Step three, look at the retail clients. She has 4. The de minimis limit is 5. Because 4 is less than or equal to 5, she is exempt. No registration required in Oklahoma.
The moment she signs retail client number 6 in Oklahoma, she has crossed the line and must register.
Instantly.
If you follow those steps, check for the office. Separate the institutions from the retail, Pete. You won't get tricked on the exam. Now, I want to shift gears completely.
Where are we heading?
We've been hanging out with Paula and Bob in the state regulator sandbox. But what happens when an advisor gets too big for the state to handle? When does the federal government step in? Let's bring in our heavyweight, Fiona, the federal advisor. Enter the SEC.
Oh, Fiona. We are now moving out of the Uniform Securities Act, the state law, and into the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, which is federal law. Specifically, we need to talk about NSMIA.
NSMIA, National Securities Markets Improvement Act of 1996. Why does 1996 matter? What changed?
Before 1996, massive investment advisors had to register with the SEC and D with every single state they did business in.
Oh my God, the paperwork.
It was a dual registration nightmare. Wall Street lobbied hard against this, arguing it was wildly inefficient. So Congress passed NSMIA, which effectively split the regulatory world in half based on assets under management, or AUM. They created the AUM ladder.
The AUM ladder. Let's map out these thresholds clearly, because the test demands you know these numbers cold.
Right.
What is the bottom rung of the ladder?
The bottom rung is under $25 million in AUM. These are defined as small advisors. They must register with the state or states where they do business.
Can they choose the SEC?
No. The SEC is actually legally forbidden from registering them. They don't want to waste federal resources on small shops.
Okay, less than $25 million, you belong to the state administrator. What is the next run?
$25 million up to $100 million. This is the mid-sized tier. Generally speaking, these advisors also must register with the state.
Wait. I'm stopping you right there. You said generally, state for the $25 to $100 million mid-sized group. What are the exceptions? This smells like exam gotcha number 3.
You're right to flag that. There are exceptions, and they are highly testable because they deal with regulatory quirks. The biggest and most important exception is the New York rule.
Why New York?
New York state law, specifically the Martin Act, is very unique. New York requires investment advisors to register, but it does not subject its state-registered IAs to routine regulatory examinations or inspections.
Wait, what?
Yeah, they rely mostly on prosecuting fraud after the fact, rather than proactively auditing books.
So New York says, register with us, pay the fee, but then they never come knock on your door to check your compliance.
Exactly. Because of that lack of proactive oversight, federal lawmakers decided that a mid-sized advisor managing, say, $50 million shouldn't be operating with zero routine inspections.
That makes sense.
So the rule says, if a mid-sized advisor has its principal office in New York, they cannot just rely on the state. They must register with the SEC instead so that someone is auditing them.
Listeners, New York is the one state name you must memorize for this exam regarding mid-sized advisors. If you see a mid-sized advisor headquartered in New York, they bypass the state and go straight to the SEC.
Correct.
What are the other exceptions for mid-sized?
Well, if a state has no IA law at all, Wyoming was the last holdout for a long time, though they have one. Now there is no state mandate, so they would go SEC.
Sure.
But a much more common exception is based on client type, regardless of AUM. If you are an advisor to a mutual fund, a registered investment company, you go straight to the SEC.
Even if you're tiny.
It doesn't matter if you only manage $5 million. Mutual funds are federal products, so their advisors are federally regulated.
Mutual fund advisors go federal, always. Got it.
Yeah.
So let's keep climbing the ladder. We are past $100 million now.
Between $100 million and $110 million, SEC registration becomes optional. The advisor can choose to stay with the states, or they can choose to transition to the SEC.
And the top rung?
$110 million or more. Mandatory SEC registration. Welcome to the big leagues, Fiona. You are now a federal covered advisor.
Now let's look at the mechanics of that gap. Why have a buffer zone between $90 million and $110 million?
Think about market volatility.
I compare this to a yo-yo diet. You know, you lose a pound, you gain a pound, you go up a pant size, you go down a size. The stock market fluctuates every single day.
Every minute.
Right. If Fiona has exactly $100 million in AUM and the market dips 2% on a Tuesday, she suddenly has $98 million. If there was a hard single number line at 100, she'd have to deregister with the SEC and re-register with 15 different states every time the market had a bad week.
The regulatory burden and the paperwork would be completely absurd. So Congress created a buffer zone to absorb market volatility. It works like a one-way valve. On the way up, as your business grows, you don't have to register with the SEC until you hit $110 million.
But once you cross 110 and you are federally registered, you don't get kicked out for a small dip.
Right. Once you are an SEC-registered federal-covered advisor, you are allowed to stay there, even if your AUM drops below $110, below $100. You don't have to withdraw and go back to the states until your AUM drops all the way below $90 million.
Ah, so the safe buffer zone is 90 to 110.
Exactly.
And there are specific timelines for this switching process, right? You don't just wake up one morning, see your AUM hit $115 million, and flip a switch.
No, there is a transition period. If you are climbing the ladder, you are state-registered, and your annual updating amendment shows your AUM just hit $115 million. You have 90 days to register with the SEC once you become eligible.
90 days on the way up. What about the way down? The market crashes. Fiona's AUM drops to $85 million. She's got to go back to the state minor leagues.
On the downward bound path, she has 180 days after her fiscal year end to withdraw her SEC registration using Form 80VW and get fully registered with the states.
Why does she get double the time on the way down?
Because registering with multiple states is a much heavier administrative lift than registering with a single federal SEC. So 90 days up, 180 days down.
Let's talk about federal preemption, because this is where state and federal powers collide. Fiona is a federal covered advisor. She manages $500 million. She's registered with the SEC. Can the state administrator of Texas just ignore her?
They cannot.
Can the administrator say, oh, she's federal, we have no jurisdiction or power over her whatsoever?
Absolutely not. Federal preemption means the state administrator cannot force Fiona to register as a state IA. The state cannot deny her federal license, and the state cannot set minimum net worth or record-keeping requirements that exceed federal rules.
But the state still has some power.
Significant retained power. The state demands three things from federal covered advisors operating within their borders.
What are the three demands?
First, notice filings. Fiona must send the state administrator copies of all the exact same paperwork she filed with the SEC.
Okay, so the state is like, we see you.
Right. The state says, we know we can't reject your application, but we demand to know who you are and what you're doing in our state. Second, filing fees.
Always about the money.
Always. The state still wants its tax revenue. Fiona has to pay a fee to operate there. And third, and most importantly, the state retains the absolute right to enforce its anti-fraud laws.
Ah, Section 102 strikes again.
Always. If Fiona commits fraud in Texas, the Texas administrator will bring the hammer down, federal covered or not.
There is a mechanical exception to that notice filing rule, though, right? Tying back to what we learned earlier about institutional clients.
Yes. If Fiona is a federal covered advisor and her only client clients in a specific state are institutional clients, she doesn't even have to do a notice filing or pay a fee in that state. Federal law protects that cross-border institutional business entirely.
Okay, let's bring it back down to the state level and talk about post-registration reality. We're moving into the final major phase of the regulatory life cycle.
Good, because getting registered is just the start.
Right. Let's say Paula is officially state registered. She's got her ADV filed, her consent to service is locked in as her permanent legal address, she paid her fee, noon on the 30th day has passed. Is the administrator out of her hair? Can she just run her business however she wants until December 31st?
Not even close. Registration is just the beginning of the relationship. The administrator has ongoing, continuous authority over Paula's finances, her records, and her operations.
Let's talk about the financial requirements. I imagine the state doesn't want broke, financially unstable investment advisors managing people's life savings.
Definitely not. The administrator has the power to set minimum financial requirements for state-registered advisors, usually expressed as a minimum net worth.
Is it the same for everyone?
No. These aren't just random, arbitrary numbers applied to everyone equally. The requirements are triggered based on two massive responsibilities an advisor might choose to take on.
The triggers, what are they?
Trigger number one, having custody of client funds or securities. Custody doesn't just mean holding physical stock certificates in a safe. It means you have direct or indirect access to client assets.
Like what? Give me an example.
If Paula has the authority to directly deduct her advisory fees from the client's brokerage account, that is legally considered custody.
Oh, really? Just taking her fee out?
Yep. Trigger number two, having discretionary authority. This means Paula can execute trades in a client's account, deciding what to buy, how much to buy, and when to buy without asking the client for permission first.
Custody and discretion. Those are the magic words that increase your risk profile. If Paula just gives advice, hey, I think you should buy this stock, but the client has to log into their own account and click the buy button themselves, Paula doesn't have custody or discretion.
Correct. And in that scenario where she has no custody and no discretion, her minimum financial requirement set by the state would be quite low, perhaps only $10,000, or in some states, non-existent.
But if she takes on custody?
The state says, whoa, you have direct access to client money now. The risk of theft or insolvency impacting the client is huge. We need to make sure you're financially stable. That's when the higher net worth requirements kick in, often $35,000 for custody and $10,000 for discretion.
And what if Paula wants to have custody? She wants to deduct her fees directly, but her personal net worth is kind of shaky. Let's say the state requires a $35,000 net worth for custody and Paula only has $15,000 in the bank. Does she just have to close up shop?
The administrator allows an alternative. They can require a surety bond to bridge that gap.
Let's define that because people confuse it with regular insurance. What is a surety bond mechanically?
Mechanically, a surety bond is a financial guarantee issued by a third-party bonding company. It guarantees that if Paula violates the Uniform Securities Act and steals client money, the bonding company will pay the state or the clients up to the amount of the bond, say, $35,000.
So the client is protected?
Yes. And then, crucially, the bonding company will aggressively hunt Paula down to get their money back. It protects the public, not Paula.
Okay, but here is a crucial exam point about surety bonds and state power. What if Paula is absolutely crushing it? The state requires $35,000 for custody, and Paula's net worth is a cool $2 million. Can the administrator look at her and say, you know what, you're rich, but we still want you to buy a $35,000 surety bond just to be extra safe?
No. The law is very strict on this. They cannot stack the requirements.
They'll double dipping.
Right. If Paula's minimum net worth already exceeds the state's requirement, the administrator cannot force her to get a surety bond on top of it. It's one or the other. You either meet the net worth organically or you post the bond to cover the shortfall.
And she can always substitute cash for securities instead of a bond, right? If she doesn't want to deal with a bonding company, she can just lock up $35,000 in a state depository.
Exactly. The statute explicitly says that an appropriate deposit of cash or securities must be accepted by the administrator in lieu of a surety bond.
Let's talk about keeping the state updated. Paula registers in January. Everything on her form ADV is perfectly accurate. 6 months later, in July, she moves her office across town to a bigger suite, and she decides to change her fee structure from a flat hourly rate to a percentage of assets under management.
Major changes.
Does she just wait until the December 31st renewal to tell the state about these changes?
No. The rule is that if information in any document filed with the administrator becomes inaccurate or incomplete in a material way, she must file a correcting amendment promptly.
Promptly. Usually interpreted as within 30 days. And the trigger word there is materiality. What does that mean in plain English for the exam?
It means if the change is a big deal to a client or a regulator, fix it immediately. A change in fee structure, a change in business address, a change in ownership or controlling partners, a new disciplinary action or criminal charge. Those are highly material facts.
The client needs to know.
Clients need to know them right away to make informed decisions. If she just corrects a typo in the second paragraph of her firm brochure or adds a new non-executive employee, that's not material. She can wait and update that during the annual December renewal. But a material change requires a prompt amendment.
Okay, I have one final absurdity for you before we wrap up. Let's bring back our old friend, Bob the Broker.
Ah, Bob. What is he doing now?
Bob has been a broker-dealer agent for 20 years. He is highly successful. He knows the markets inside and out. He makes his firm millions. He finally decides he wants to leave the broker side, stop earning commissions, and become a full-fledged fee-only investment advisor.
Okay, a career change.
He submits his application to the state, but the administrator reviews it and denies his application for lack of qualification. Can Bob sue the administrator, claiming his 20 years of massive success as a broker makes him automatically qualified to be an IA?
He can sue, but he will absolutely lose that case.
Really?
Yeah. The Uniform Securities Act is explicit. Being a successful broker does not automatically qualify you to be an investment advisor.
I would push back if I were Bob. I'd say, why not? I've been dealing with stocks and bonds for 2 decades. I know exactly how this works.
The administrator would reply that the roles are fundamentally legally different. A broker-dealer agent is essentially in a sales role. Their legal duty is suitability, making sure the product isn't wildly inappropriate for the client.
Right.
An investment advisor acts in a fiduciary capacity. They are providing holistic, tailored advice and must put the client's interests entirely above their own. The skill sets, the ethical frameworks, and the legal obligations are completely distinct.
So they can just say no.
The administrator can legally deny Bob if he lacks the specific training. Exams like the Series 65 or 66, or knowledge required for the fiduciary IA side of the business, regardless of his 20-year resume selling mutual funds.
To use an analogy, you're an incredibly successful car salesman, Bob, but that doesn't mean you automatically know how to be a mechanic.
That's the perfect way to look at it. The state protects the public by ensuring you are qualified for the specific hat you are wearing.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We've gone from the basic combination lock definition of an advisor all the way to surety bonds, NSMIA, and net worth requirements. For my fellow ADHD learners out there who need a quick reset to lock this into short-term memory, it is time for the rapid-fire recap.
Let's do it.
We are going to ping-pong the top testable takeaways from this deep dive. I'll start. Number one, the ABC test, advice, business, compensation, it is a combination lock. If you miss even one of those digits, you are not an investment advisor.
Number two, compensation is broadly defined as any ye economic benefit. It is not just an hourly fee, indirect commissions, third-party payments, or a pastrami sandwich all count if they are tied to the advice.
Number three, the LATE professionals, lawyers, accountants, teachers, engineers, and broker-dealers are completely excluded from the definition if their advice is solely incidental to their primary job. But BDs have an extra hurdle. They must receive NO special compensation, like a wrap fee.
Number four, the publisher exclusion. It is entirely about whether the advice is impersonal in general or tailored to the specific client. Circulation size does not matter. A newsletter for 3 people qualifies if it's general. A tailored letter for 10,000 people loses the exclusion.
Number five, the out-of-state exemptions. The institutional client exemption and the de minimis exemption, which is 5 or fewer retail clients in a rolling 12 months. Both of these absolutely require that the advisor has no place of business in that state.
Number six, the AUM ladder. Under $25 million goes to the state. $110 million and up goes to the SEC as a federal covered advisor. The buffer zone to handle market volatility is $90 million to $110 million. And remember the New York exception. Mid-sized advisors headquartered in NY go straight to the SEC because NY doesn't conduct routine exams.
Number 7, the consent to service of process. You file it once CNE, it is an irrevocable legal forwarding address, and it outlives your business. You cannot escape a lawsuit by deregistering.
Number 8, expiration. December 31st for everyone. Brokers, agents, IAs, IIRs, no exceptions, no matter what month you originally registered.
That is the bedrock right there. If you understand the mechanisms behind those 8 points, you aren't just going to pass this section of the exam. You're going to understand how the entire financial regulatory system breathes.
Absolutely.
But before we go, I want to leave you, the listener, with a brain bender. A provocative final thought to mull over while you're driving or walking the dog. We spent a lot of time talking about how holding yourself out as a financial planner instantly makes you an IA because you're meeting that business test.
Right.
The laws we discussed today were largely written in 1940 and 1956. But think about the digital age we live in right now. Think about TikTok or Instagram. If you are a finfluencer, dropping generic stock tips and short videos, maybe doing a little technical analysis on a chart, and you are getting paid not by the viewers, but in ad revenue by the platform itself. Are you holding yourself out as an advisor?
Well, that's a good question.
Are you acting as a publisher protected by the First Amendment? Or are you just an unregistered investment advisor hiding in plain sight, earning indirect compensation via algorithmic ad payouts?
It's a massive, fascinating gray area right now, and state administrators are actively debating how to handle it.
The laws are still desperately trying to catch up to your smartphone. Keep an eye out for how state regulators are hunting down influencers next, because you know Paula the Planner is already trying to figure out how to monetize her TikTok without triggering a state audit.
She definitely is.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the regulatory matrix. You've got the tools, you understand the mechanisms, and you know where the traps are hidden. Go crush that exam.
Best of luck, everyone. Keep stuttering the why, not just the what.